Well, Paul begins in verse 17. He says, "Join in following my example and observe those who walk according to the pattern you have in us." Previously in the context, Paul was dealing with false teachers, false religion. These were people that were terrorizing other people, trying to make them in a fearful, threatening way think that they were going to hell because they weren't good enough to come to God. And so Paul has been dealing with that, and then he got into the subject of spiritual growth. You know, what's at the core of true spirituality? Well, it's love. That's what it is. That's what it's all about. And Paul is saying, not all religion is created equal. I'm sure you've sensed that. You know, some people say, well, you got into some religion, good for you. I'm hesitant to say that. I'm very reticent to say, oh, you got into some religion. Religion is responsible for a lot of self-righteousness, a lot of greed, a lot of wickedness, a lot of evil. And Paul is saying, not all examples are created equal. So he says, join in following my example and those who are following this pattern of grace teaching. For, he says, many walk, not just some, many walk, of whom I often told you and now tell you, even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of Christ. Wait. I thought this was supposed to be the epistle of joy. Paul uses the term joy or rejoice some 16 times in this little four-chapter letter. But here we see him weeping. Let me add insult to injury. This is the only recorded time in the New Testament that we see Paul crying. So finally, the burden of being in prison has just weighed on Paul until he's finally cracked. I mean, he's in prison in an unjust social situation where he's being punished unrighteously. He's chained to a guard. He's lonely. He can't be doing the things that he wants to do. And finally, the weight of that has just created stress fractures. And Paul is finally, he's broken down right before our eyes. That's why he's weeping. Oh, no. Why is he weeping? He isn't weeping for himself. He's weeping for his enemies. Paul's looking at these people who have rejected the love and forgiveness, the complete acceptance of Jesus Christ, and it broke his heart to think about these people. He starts thinking about them with tears in his eyes. He says, their end is destruction. Think about that. What a life that would be. To be waking up every day and moving toward your own destruction. For these people who are living under law and trying to be better people so that they can earn God's favor and go to heaven. That whole self-improvement thesis. Yeah, what is the net result of that? First of all, it's terror because you're never sure if you're good enough. And Paul says, let's get real. The end of that is destruction. So for them, this world, this fallen, fractured, broken world, is the closest to heaven they'll ever get. Secondly, he says their God is their appetite. Now, real quickly, we need to do a little bit of a word study. This word appetite, or in some of your translations, is going to say stomach, is the word koilia. And the word koilia can be used literally or metaphorically. It can mean a hollow or cavity. Literally, the word is like an emptiness or a hollow cavity. So, that's why they would translate it stomach. It's a hollow cavity. It can also be translated the seat of inward life, of feelings and desires, or belly. So it could be translated either literally to refer to a literal physical organ, the stomach, or it could be translated metaphorically to refer to an aching sense of emptiness in a person. Which use is in play here? Their God is their stomach. Their God is their appetite. Surely, Paul doesn't mean that they literally have a God in their belly. He must be thinking that they're worshiping, they're serving, they're sacrificing for this inner aching emptiness, this longing of the soul. And I don't know if you've ever been through this, where you've had that sense that, you know, I've got the car, and I've got the apartment, and I've got the girlfriend, and I've got the grades, and I got the money, and yet something's missing. What is that? It's your God is your koilia. It's your emptiness. And Paul is thinking about these people as the tears are running down his face. He says their glory is in their shame. The things which they think are great from this religious perspective actually turn out to be shameful in the eyes of God. He concludes, why is their whole lives, is this such a mess? Why? I mean, what could make people degrade into such a state? He says the reason is that they set their minds on earthly things. So for Paul, what he's concluding here is, without eternity, this life is all that we have. And we're losing it, minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year. We're losing it on little YouTube videos. We're losing it on video games. We're losing it on movies and education and vacations and experiences. And of course, I know you know what I'm saying. I'm not saying all these things are like from the devil or something like that. But you know my point, that you get to the end of your life and you say, what was it all about? What did it all mean? And this life was all that there was. And why was I here for my 40, 60, 80 years? And so Paul is taking the subject head on. Well, this subject of death, forget religion, forget politics, forget any other subject which you think is taboo, which your grandmother said you're not supposed to talk about at the dinner table. That's impolite. You can't. You want to really bother people? You really want to shut people up at the dinner table? Start talking about death. That will bring a complete silence. You want to make people really uncomfortable? Forget politics. Forget religion. Start talking about how a loved one in your life died. Start talking about what it was like to see the body. Start talking about what it was like to go to the funeral. And some people will get completely silent. Others will start to speak nervously, certain platitudes and aphorisms, just diarrhea of the mouth, like they don't know what to say, so they just spit out whatever they can. Other people will just get up and leave. Because death is the ultimate taboo subject. And according to the Bible, Hebrews chapter 2, verse 15, every single human being has an innate, incredible fear of death. For some people, they would say, I don't fear death. Well, that's only because you're denying your fear of death. In fact, the Pulitzer Prize winning author, Ernest Becker, in 1976, wrote his book, The Denial of Death, based on that premise. And this is very popular in the literature today. If you study death, if you study what psychologists and philosophers and different thinkers today say about this subject, it's that humans do fear death, but they deny it. So, for example, we could have a secular philosopher, Luc Ferry. Luc Ferry was an actor from the 90s. Luc Ferry is a French secular philosopher. He writes this in his book, A Brief History of Thought. A human knows that he will die and that his near ones, those he loves, will also die. Consequently, he cannot prevent himself from thinking about this state of affairs, which is disturbing and absurd, almost unimaginable. To think not only of your own death, that someday you're going to be looking up at the ceiling, gasping out your final breaths, but to think that the loved ones in your life so too will die. Ferry writes, the quest for a salvation without God, now remember, he's a secular philosopher, not a believer in God. The quest for a salvation without God is at the heart of every great philosophical system. That is a profound statement. I hope you caught what he said. Every philosophy that humans have created, at the center, at the crux, is this project of trying to find salvation from death apart from God. And he says that is its essential and ultimate objective. Sigmund Bauman, a sociologist and philosopher, writes, there is hardly a thought more offensive than that of death, or rather, the inevitability of dying, of the transience or the temporariness of our being in the world. The horror of death is the horror of the void and is, quote, bound to remain traumatic. That this is traumatizing. Think of it like this. I don't know if you're into science fiction or dystopian movies, books, and so forth, but I am. So I'll give you an illustration from dystopia, negative utopia. Imagine there's a government that develops technology that they can go into your life and go through all of your friends and family members around you, all of your classmates and colleagues and coworkers, everyone that you've ever met, and they have some kind of advanced technology that can erase every memory of you. And they can erase your complete online footprint and presence. That's completely gone. Your birth certificates, your driver's license, your first grade report card, everything is completely wiped away for you. What would it be like to see all of your loved ones and friends when they have absolutely no memory of you? Just think of the horror of going up to your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your friends, your roommates, and they have no memories of you whatsoever. Well, that isn't some kind of a science fiction picture. That is the future for each and every one of us in this room. At a certain point in the future, all of our collective memories will be erased at the moment of death. And this is going to happen one of two ways. Either your friends and loved ones will live long enough so that you can die by a murder or a disease or an accident, or you will live long enough to see them die by a murder or a disease or an accident. But either way, we're going to be severed from the people we love the most. Edwin Schneidman, he's a thanatologist. Thanatos in Greek means death. So he's a studier of death, and he's a 90-year-old studier of death. So he's about to be death and pretty soon. And this is his reflections. He says, to cease as though one had never been, to exit life with no hope of living on in the memory of another, to be expunged from history's record, that is a fate literally far worse than death. To have been completely wiped clean from the face of the earth. Irvin Yalom, he's a psychiatrist. He also in his book offers a Epicurean philosophy on life. He writes, I share the fear of death with every human being. Now, he's a psychiatrist saying this, that seeing tens of thousands of patients, he's saying every human being has the fear of death. It is our dark shadow from which we are never severed. Despite the staunchest, most venerable defenses, we can never completely subdue death anxiety. It is always there, lurking in some hidden ravine of the mind. This is especially scary because we have no guarantees. The life expectancy right now is about 78 years. The life expectancy. So many people think, I've got 78 years to live. No. That's the life expectancy. That's not the life guarantee. You have no life guarantee. You could die tomorrow. You could die tonight. There is no guarantee whatsoever. Well, denial. This is one approach to how to deal with death. Number two is health and fitness. And again, I want to be very clear. I'm not against eating healthy food. I'm not against taking care of your body. Fitness, very good for you. Good for your mental health. Good for your energy. Good for your quality of life. Good for your confidence. Everything else. I mean, it's a very good thing. What I'm speaking of here is people thinking that they can avoid the fear of death by eating whole foods and by going for walks or by joining a CrossFit gym. Good luck. Think about it like this. All of these different multi-million dollar book sales on some of the biggest diets and fads that we've seen in the last, 20, 30, 40 years. I mean, all these books that people neurotically read so that they can keep their health and extend their lives a few years. Did you know Adele Davis, 10.5 million copies of her book, Let's Eat Right to Keep Fit? Adele Davis died of cancer at age 70. Montagnac, Michel Montagnac, he was a French author of this book. This was the predecessor for the South Beach diet. You're like, I don't know what that is. Well, people knew what it was 10 years ago. This was the real fad diet. He died of cancer at age 66. The new book, Younger Next Year, great title, by a medical doctor, Henry Lodge, he died of cancer at age 58. The Complete Book of Running by James Fix. James Fix. He was obese. All of a sudden he started to eat better and jog back in the 70s. And you know how like sometimes you'll look out your door and you'll see a person jogging down the street and you say, hey, that's normal. Like people jog today. Back in the 70s, nobody jogged. Nobody just had the idea, I'm going to put on short shorts and a V-neck and I'm going to go out and I'm going to jog. Like I'm just going to run down the street. People would have looked at you like you were crazy. Until Jim Fix came along and he wrote a best-selling book. These are all bestsellers. Jim Fix. And he was on commercials and speaking deals. And he wrote this book and everyone started to jog. Why do people jog today? Jim Fix. That's why. Guess what happened to Jim Fix? He died while running at the age of 52. Now, I don't say this with any kind of glee or any kind of, you know, oh, yeah, that shows him. He shouldn't have been a runner. I think we should take care of our health and our fitness. My point is, let me repeat again, so as to be clear. My point is that these are not a way to deal with death. Do you know that it's been studied that if we could eliminate all forms of cancer, the life expectancy would go from 78 to 81. Oh, we're going to get rid of cancer and we're going to live into our hundreds. No, no, no. Death is still a specter which is hanging over all of us. Another way to deal with death is to have kids. This is kind of a symbolic way to pass on who you are to your offspring. There's problems, major problems. For one, what if you never have kids? What if you never get married? What if you choose not to have kids? What if, God forbid, you lose your kids? Your kids die. What does that mean for you? Does that mean that you no longer have meaning in the face of death? Some people say, well, my genetic makeup is going to make it into my offspring. Did you know that by the 10th generation from you, your offspring will have 0.05% of your genetic makeup? And by the way, they will have no idea who you are. In talking to groups of this size for years, I've asked people, who here knows the names, just the first names, not the habits or, you know, beliefs or anything, the hobbies, of their great-grandparents? Who knows that? You do? Okay, what's their name? You made that up, clearly.
Her name was Iverson, so
Iverson. Do you care? This person that was so integral to your life that you learned her name, that means you really loved her. Now you know her name. Do you care? No. What about 10 generations from now? People won't even, no one will know who you are. And if they do, you'll appear in a footnote. Won't that be great? Then people will see your name in a footnote. Another problem with this is if meaning comes from kids, then that means that I'm really having kids to exploit them for my meaning. This is a profoundly unloving approach to parenthood. It's having children so that I can take meaning from them. You wonder why parents, you know, I remember one guy I knew. He was running his kids into sport after sport after sport. He was going to be this hockey star. And he was, you know, 6'3" and 270 pounds. He was a big cop, you know, big tough guy. And I was like, hey, Mr. So-and-so, you know, what sports did you play in high school? And he's like, I never played sports. Why then was he pushing his kid into every sport imaginable? It wasn't for the kid's benefit. It's because he was living through the child. It's taking from the kid, not giving. Having kids, no, this isn't a way to deal with death. The idea that I'm going to transcend death through my kids. Give me a break. Another approach is very much an Eastern approach, like we see in Buddhism, for example, to detach from people. So, in other words, all of that pain of being severed from your relationships, that's pretty bad. So, in order to deal with the pain, one could remove oneself from relationships, detaching emotionally, relationally, physically, to the point where you don't deal with people so that when you're severed from them, you don't feel people being severed. That's one approach. Siddhartha Gautama. Siddhartha was his first name. Gautama was his clan. The Buddha, the enlightened one. In roughly the 5th, 6th century, left his wife and newborn son in the middle of the night without saying goodbye to go become enlightened. To detach. That's the third noble truth of Buddhism, is to detach from the attachments and pleasures of this world. That's what he discovered, is not to hold your loved ones closely, but to detach and to realize that it's all samsara. It's maya. It's illusion. It's to detach from these relationships. Far more recently, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who is a secular psychologist, I'm sure you've heard of her, if not her name, then her content, she was the one that came up with the five stages of grief. Remember the five stages of grief? Well, the fifth stage of grief is acceptance. Well, for years I thought, well, that must mean that it's a good thing, that finally people at the end of their lives, they come to a point of acceptance, that I'm going to die. But here's what she writes on page 109 of her book, On Death and Dying. She writes, quote, "The terminally ill will reach a stage during which he is neither depressed nor angry about his fate." That sounds pretty good. Acceptance, though, should not be mistaken for a happy stage. It is almost void of feeling. How is it that you're able to deal with death, the horror of death, the terror of death? It's that you become numb. It's that you accept it and you turn into something that is less than human. If you do this, if you detach from those that you love to deal with death, if you shut down inside, there's something inside you, very human, that's going to die so that you can deal with death. What about scientific advances? This is where it gets real spooky. The line between science fiction and science has become very blurred in popular culture. Why? Because science is boring. And newspapers don't like to print stuff about science because usually it's boring. So what they like to do is bring in popularizers on science. Yay! People that can write and, you know, that can make, basically extrapolate all these scientific things that are happening, even if it's not really true. And so we hear about all these scientific advancements. For example, the big one right now is referred to as what's called transhumanism. Elon Musk is a big fan here. A bunch of the big moguls and tycoons of various businesses hold to transhumanism. This is the belief that eventually we'll be able to upload our brains and all of their synapses into a hard drive or computer and have a bionic body and hence live forever. This is the view. There's five problems with this view. Number one, the computer problem. A computer is going to hold everything in my brain. David Chalmers, a transhumanist himself, he's a professor of philosophy and neuroscience at NYU, he says, quote, "No such technology is currently even on the horizon." Now, this is a guy who's actually advocating for this view. So, Dr. Chalmers, is the technology going to be there by the time you die? No. It's not even on that. We can't even see it from here. Number two, the consciousness problem. Like we have a brain. We have a brain filled with myelin that covers the neurons and synapses and electricity and juices and fat. But then we have consciousness. We're trying to explain what that is. How do you go from different material parts to actually having thoughts, feelings? Thoughts about things, that's consciousness. Well, there's a problem with downloading your immaterial consciousness onto a material hard drive. Again, Chalmers, our buddy, he says, we have no idea how a non-biological system, such as silicon computational system, could be conscious. No kidding, yeah. How does a silicon computational device all of a sudden say, I think, therefore I am? How do you go from processing zeros and ones to having thoughts? Those are not the same idea, not even close. He says, quote, there is nothing even approaching an orthodox theory of why there is consciousness in the first place. Do you understand what he just said? Not only do we not know how to put consciousness into a computer, we don't even know what consciousness is. How do you put something that you don't even know what it is into something else, not knowing what it is in the first place? The consciousness problem. Then there's the complexity problem. Oh, it only gets worse. The human brain has 100 billion neurons, each of which has 10,000 different connections. So if we put this together, that would be 1,000 trillion connections. A quadrillion. 1,000 trillion. 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 whatever you want to say, all right? A quadrillion. That's a lot. That's like a zillion, which isn't even a number. Okay, let's compare the human brain, a quadrillion connections, with synehabiditis elegans, otherwise known as the roundworm, the simplest animal on earth. Michael Hendricks of McGill University, a neuroscientist, he says this is the best described animal in all of biology. We know of its genes and all its cells, a little over 1,000 cells. We know the complete synaptic connectivity of its 302 neurons. And we have known about it since the 90s, 30 years. 302 neurons, and compared to 100 billion neurons in the brain, okay, where's he going with this? He says if we could, quote-unquote, upload or roughly simulate any brain, it should be that of the roundworm. Yet, even with the full connectome in hand, a static model of this network of connections lacks the most of the information necessary to simulate the mind of the worm. We can't even replicate the mind of a worm, the simplest biological animal, which we have fully mapped out. There's no surprises. And we've had it mapped out for 3 decades. We can't even upload that worm's consciousness at all. This is coming from a guy who's a professional in his field. Cryogenic freezing. This comes from the Greek word kairos, which means freezing, cryogenic freezing. This is, don't let anyone ever tell you, yeah, I'm just going to be cryogenically frozen, or he's going to be cryogenic. We're all going to be cryogenically frozen. It's all going to work out. Then they'll just wake us up later. Like, there's going to be people in the future. They're going to want to wake me up. Like, what are they doing in the future without me? Like, they're going to be looking at, like, global warming and, like, racism and, like, evil, all these things. And they're going to be like, we want you around, right, in the future. So they're going to be there wanting me. They're going to wake me up. Well, here's the problem with cryogenic freezing. You got to get down negative 100 Celsius. Okay, so zero is freezing. Negative 100. To do that, your brain, the cells, begin to die within 4 to 6 minutes. What this means is you need to be in hospice care on site so that when you die, they can immediately put you into liquid nitrogen. So if you slip and fall, if you get into a car accident, if you get into a fist fight, if you die in a plane crash, anything like that, you're gone. You're a goner. There's no freezing you and bringing you back later. Won't exist. Does not exist. Number two, we've never cryogenically frozen any animal bigger than a millimeter. Here's this little guy here, tardigrade. He's a little millimeter. We froze him and brought him back. Okay, congratulations. And this has been brought back. Nothing else. Not even a cockroach. They survived nuclear holocaust. They can't survive this, what we're talking about here. So too, there is a thing referred to as acoustic fracturing events. Have you ever put cold ice cubes into a warm glass of water in the summer? Yeah, that one person said yes, great. My illustration will work. You put an ice cube in, and do you ever hear that sound that it makes, that and you put another ice cube in, another ice cube in. Guess what the brain is made of? Fat. Water. The brain is made of fat and water. The myelination, the myelin, is little fatty grease basically over the neurons. And we have 100 billion of those. And you're freezing the brain down to a negative 100 Celsius. When you do this, you hear acoustic fracturing events. You hear the brain literally shattering. The synapse is breaking. To be a little boy watching his dad get cryogenically frozen, you'd be looking to your mom like, Mommy, why is Daddy making that noise? That's really morbid, isn't it? Why'd you guys laugh at that? That's sad. Number five, clones. Let's say this all works. We're cryogenically frozen. We reach the singularity. Robots love us. Future loves us. We get unfrozen. Nanotechnology. It all comes together. It's great. And they make a complete clone of me. What happens to me? So there's a complete clone of me. That's great. He looks and talks and acts exactly like me. What happens to me? I die. So I made a duplicate of myself. It's kind of like that movie, The Prestige, with Hugh Jackman. Yeah, spoiler. At the end, he finds out that he keeps making clones of himself, and one of the clones is dying each time. Well, congratulations, that's great. You've learned how to live forever, only it won't be you when you get there. It'll be a clone of you, a complete replica of you. Other people, you know what it is? Most people are not trying to get cryogenically frozen. That's not the issue. Most people are just in complete amusement and distraction. Just trying to get stimulated, drunk, stoned, laid, workaholics, alcoholics, I mean, any kind of thing, just to distract themselves from what is obviously coming. It's so bizarre. Something as natural as death, something that happens to every person, we have the ingrained sense that there's something unnatural about it. It's something that we are all going to face, and yet we don't want to look at it. We don't want to think about it. And so it's distraction. People who say, I don't really fear death, that's only because you don't think about it. That is the only reason. If you truly reflected upon this, you'd be scared to death. Well, other people just lie to themselves. This is where we make up religion, basically, to meet our needs. And so basically, however I'm doing, like if I think I'm a good person, then my religion is good people go to heaven like me. Or we have little platitudes, you know, I'm sending warm vibes your way and everything's going to be okay. And he's going to be up there, you know, he's going to be driving around that Corvette like he used to. And basically, what is this? What is this? Some kind of a designer heaven? Like we get to make up the afterlife? Well, here's a question. On what basis, on what evidential basis do you know that there's an afterlife? People have never thought about this before. The most taboo, terrifying thing, which we're all going to face, they've never sat down and looked into this at all. You know, I look at that. That is horrifying. I have to admit, no wonder Paul is sitting there with tears in his eyes, thinking about these guys. You know, he's the one in prison, unjustly put there. But he's looking at these guys. They're out free, and, you know, they're doing whatever they want. And but Paul's looking at these guys weeping. To have everything but not have Christ is to have nothing. And to have nothing but have Christ is to have everything. And Paul is looking at these guys just thinking to himself, they're hopeless, they're empty, everything they do is temporary, it's going to end. And you know, in a universe without God, that's the end of this story. That's it. You die, you become worm food, that's it. That's all. Show's over. Curtain closes. But not according to the Bible. Paul continues. He says, but our citizenship is in heaven. Right now, you can know, sitting right here. This isn't a thing that you die and then you wonder, am I going to go to heaven or not? He says, our citizenship, note the present tense, our citizenship is right now at this moment in heaven. From which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ will transform the body of our humble bodies into conformity with the body of His glory by the exertion of the power that He has even to subject all things to Himself. That is hope. This is not a pipe dream. This is real. You know, we talked about people, you know, your offspring, you're never going to know you. You know, Jesus never had any offspring. But we still talk about Jesus today. You know who is the most influential person in human history? Jesus of Nazareth. We still talk about him today. And the reason why is because his claims are true. He's real. God came into our world as the king. He came in as king and died for our sins, all of our moral violations, so that we could be forgiven. And the Bible says he's coming back and he's going to bring heaven with him. Let's end with the words of Luke Ferry. He says, compared to Christianity, whose promise of the resurrection of the body means we shall be reunited with those we love after death, a humanism with metaphysics is small beer. He's French. It's a translation error. He's saying it's a beer like O'Doul's. There's no alcohol. It's like drinking it and, you know, what's in this beer here? Compared to Christianity, our humanism without metaphysics is small beer. I grant you that amongst the available doctrines of salvation, nothing can compete with Christianity, provided, that is, that you are a believer. He may well have said, the COVID-19 vaccine will benefit you, provided you take it. Nothing can compete with Christianity, provided, that is, you are a believer. Hey, why not come back next week and explore why we would believe in the afterlife, why we think this is real, why we think this is going to be the most incredible thing ever, that instead of being terrifying, it's going to be terrific. Come back next week. We're going to go into this subject even more. And why not just devote a night of your life to looking into this?